Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the theme, The Hidden Hands. And we're looking at, is America going through a silent coup? My guest, a professor, Melvin Goodman, will be discussing this with us. We will also be joined later in the program with a discussion from Bill Moyers, interviewing the former Republican congressional aide, Mike Lofgren, who spent 27 years, and he identifies the deep state with factions within the government and private finance and industry who operate through influential networks to essentially run our nation, despite the elections and despite the consent of the citizens. We will discuss this. I'll also be referring to several articles today, including from Global Research, Larry Chen, the CIA's deep state, and Donald Trump and his war on terrorism. Also, Wim Hartung from Tom's Dispatch, What Happens When All We Have Left is the Pentagon. From Courtney Johnson, we'll be talking about, is there a cure for corporate crime? Also, a message to Nikki Haley, the U.N. ambassador, and asking, why is she not doing her homework when she tells the world that Russia was the only problem, not the United States? We'll also look at a new report that 39% of prisoners are unnecessarily behind bars. Why? If we know that nearly 40% of all of our prison population shouldn't be there, then to whose benefit is it that they're there? And is this part of the hidden hand, those who profit from this? Also, why is it we have no discussion in the United States in the media that I can find looking at all the bombs that we dropped in the last 12 months alone, including those under President Obama? The numbers are staggering. But also, more importantly, the people they impacted in the different countries, seven countries that they were dropped on, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Pakistan, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. Why are we fighting Yemen, the poorest country in the Middle East? And what are we doing to understand our partners in that part of the world, including Saudi Arabia and Turkey? Two groups of people from two countries in the Middle East who are profiting from our war on terror. And how much is it costing us? What do you think one of these bombs cost? I'll tell you. So these are just some of the issues that we're tying together in our program. But first, let's go to my guest standing by in Maryland, Professor Melvin Goodman. Nice to have you with us today.
Hello, Gary. Good to be with you. I think it's been a while, but I remember being with you before.
Yes. And for people who may not be familiar with your work, Professor Melvin Goodman is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C. He is also an adjunct professor in international relations at Johns Hopkins University. And for 24 years, through the administrations of Johnson to Bush Sr., he had served in the CIA and the Department of State as a Soviet analyst. He was also a professor of international relations at the National War College for 18 years. He writes frequently for Counterpunch and has written for the New York Times, Harper's, Foreign Policy, the Washington Post, among other publications. His seven books have dealt with Soviet studies, Star Wars, the neoconservative agenda, and the CIA. His latest book, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, validated President Eisenhower's warnings concerning the dangers of the military-industrial complex to the American economy, security, and culture. And his forthcoming Whistleblower at the CIA, The Path of Dissent, has been delayed and obstructed for almost a year by the CIA itself. Mel's website is melvingoodman.com. I'd like to begin with the issue of the conflict between Trump and the CIA and the intelligence agency. There remains a lot of uncertainty and ambiguity in this tense relationship. I found it ironic that Trump would make his first public appearance at the CIA to praise the intelligence community while taking the opportunity to attack the press. Seemingly, he is, in my personal opinion, I speak only for myself, he is completely ill-informed about the close relationship the CIA has had with the media for decades, going back as far as the Dulles brothers. And it is my understanding that during the campaign, Trump had little support from the intelligence community, but simply didn't trust that they would not allow him to be, in a sense, their close buddies. Well, he found out the hard way that that's not going to happen. We also found a new study that shows, and this is remarkable, of government employees who actually gave to Trump or Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, 99% did not give a penny to Donald Trump in every agency, the State Department, all of the different departments of government. And the vast majority didn't give to Bernie Sanders. They all gave to Hillary Clinton. I also would like for you to, at some point in our discussion this evening, to talk about the fact that at no point has the left taken a measured and objective understanding of if the entire Wall Street banking cartels, if the cabal of the pharmaceutical industry, all a big pharma, all a big agriculture, if the military-industrial complex, all of the major contractors, which represent almost 400,000 contractors, both corporations and individuals, if all of the think tanks, if all the major foundations, if all the major unions, all, for all intents and purposes, the entire corporate elite in America, they all back Clinton, the question I would have for them is, why? What were they going to get if Clinton became president and they all voted against Trump? Hence the beginning of the understanding of what it would be that Trump could do. So if you would please, take us through this understanding from your background, your deep background. Take your time and help us unravel the White House's current war with the intelligence community, the politicalization of the CIA that seems to be underway, and who can Trump trust in the intelligence community at this moment. The forum is yours.
Okay, well, let's start with something that's unprecedented, and that's Donald Trump's campaign against the CIA, which started before he was inaugurated. I've often said that presidents fall in love with two institutions. They fall in love with Camp David, and Donald Trump certainly has not fallen in love with Camp David. They'll be surprised if he ever gets there. It's much too rustic for him. And most presidents fall in love with the CIA when they realize this is a small, secret organization that responds to authority, that can move instruments around, equipment around, even special forces around because of their skill at logistics without alerting the military and going through the Pentagon and having to worry about the Congress interfering with between the president and the Pentagon. So the CIA is something that's usually been very attractive to presidents. And frankly, it started in the Eisenhower era. Eisenhower may have been correct about the warnings with regard to the military-industrial complex, but he misused the CIA, just as John F. Kennedy misused the CIA, overthrowing the legitimate government of Iran in 1953, which Eisenhower was responsible for, was an illegitimate use. Kennedy's use of the CIA against Fidel Castro in the disastrous Bay of Pigs landing was a misuse of the CIA. In fact, Harry Truman, in December of 1963, wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post talking about the misuse of the CIA. It was Truman, after all, who created the CIA in 1947 in the National Security Act. But as he said in this op-ed, and I saw his notes in his own hand when I was out at the Truman Library where I gave a lecture 2 years ago, he made it clear he did not create the CIA as a cloak-and-dagger organization. He wanted it to collect intelligence and inform the president of international events. So all presidents after Truman certainly used the CIA and mainly misused the CIA, whether it was Nixon and the overthrow of the government in Chile, the Allende government, or the way the CIA was used in Vietnam in terms of the Phoenix program. But Donald Trump is a different breed of cat. His problems with the CIA started immediately. He made the comparison between the actions of the CIA and Nazi Germany, complaining that the leaks against him personally and against his incoming administration were inspired particularly by the intelligence community, but mainly by the CIA. So without any evidence whatsoever of this kind of activity, he was very critical of the CIA, very critical of its director, John Brennan, and immediately appointed his own CIA director from the Congress, Michael Pompeo, a Tea Party congressman from Kansas. Remember, if you look at the various CIA directors over the years, Pompeo would be the third to come from Capitol Hill. There was a Representative Porter Goss, who was appointed by George Bush, and there was a congressional staffer from the Senate Intelligence Committee, George Tenet, who was appointed by Bill Clinton. I cite these two examples because both were guilty of politicizing intelligence. George Tenet was infamous for his remark to George Bush, who wanted more intelligence to justify the war in Iraq and didn't care whether the intelligence was accurate or not. And George Tenet said it would be a slam dunk to give him the intelligence that he needed, and darned if he didn't. There was a slam dunk briefing. There was a phony estimate in October of 2002, and there was a phony speech by Colin Powell that was delivered at the United Nations in February of 2003, only weeks before the invasion of Iraq. All of these documents, the speech by Powell, the estimate by the CIA, the briefing by CIA Deputy Director John McLaughlin, were based on false allegations, false information. Some of this information made out of whole cloth. So when Trump thought the CIA wouldn't do his bidding, I don't think he was familiar with the fact that the CIA has been guilty of politicizing intelligence for presidents such as Ronald Reagan and then George W. Bush. By appointing Pompeo, who's been very critical of the CIA, I think he believes he has someone in there now who will conform to what the White House wants. And what was most disturbing about Pompeo's first week in the CIA is he appointed a deputy director, which didn't get a lot of attention in the nation's media. Her name is Gina Haspel, and Haspel was one of the leading CIA operatives in operating the secret prisons and conducting policies of torture and abuse, for which there should have been greater accountability. The torture and abuse, of course, was a war crime. Now, the CIA can say they had memos from the Department of Justice that were written by John Yoo and Jay Bybee from the Bush administration to justify the interrogation techniques, but the fact of the matter is they went way beyond what the Justice Department said was justified. So even if you accept the Justice Department memos as justification for what the CIA did, the CIA was guilty of going beyond these memos, and John Yoo has even written an op-ed for the New York Times charging the CIA with going beyond what the memos mandated. My great regret in all of this is that President Obama didn't pursue accountability for what essentially were war crimes in the global war on terror. He put a stop to terror and abuse. He closed down the secret prisons. But there should have been accountability for those people who conducted this torture, and there should have been accountability for the secret prisons, and there should have been accountability for an officer by the name of Jose Rodriguez, who gave the order. He was the leading CIA official in charge of the secret prisons and the torture and abuse, and the new deputy, Haspel, ran the secret prison in Thailand. But it was Rodriguez who gave the order, and Haspel who sent the cable to destroy the torture tapes. The CIA, like good bureaucrats, filmed these sessions, these torture sessions. There were about 92 different tapes, and there was a lawsuit filed to get these tapes in order to make a court case against CIA activities. But Rodriguez gave the order to destroy them, realizing there would be worse consequences for the CIA if the tapes were found and seen by the American public than if they were simply destroyed. So this was a clear case to me of obstruction of justice. But again, there was an investigation of these acts, but again, no accountability. Rodriguez was not punished, and he was even allowed to write a book in which he denied that torture and abuse even took place. So the war between Trump and the CIA has many different facets. It's incredibly unprecedented. And then the day after his election, the first public visit he makes, as you mentioned, is to the CIA building, the headquarters, in Langley, Virginia. And everyone talks about the fact that he stood in front of the memorial wall, which memorializes the 100 or so officers who were killed in action, some of whose names can never be revealed. But they never talk about the wall opposite the memorial wall, in which there is the biblical inscription, seek the truth, and the truth will set you free. And here was Donald Trump, who throughout his campaign certainly did not speak the truth, certainly did not seek the truth, who was, I think, engaging in an act of politicization, patronizing CIA officers who were in the lobby of that building, talking about the media in an extremely threatening way, a charge that he's expanded on in recent weeks by talking about the media as enemy of the people, which is extremely dangerous language that we've heard in fascist societies that we have never heard in our democratic system. We had Richard Nixon during the worst days of Watergate talking about the media as an enemy, but he was talking about that in a personal context, that it was his enemy, not the media as enemy of the people. So you have a situation now where Trump has put in his own person, the congressman, to run the CIA. He's put in his own intelligence czar, a former senator, Dan Coats, who has no background in intelligence or national security or foreign policy. And just a few weeks ago, there was a report that was leaked to the New York Times that Trump was about to appoint a founder of a private equity firm in New York by the name of Steven Feinberg to conduct a broad investigation of the intelligence community. And what Trump is trying to do is ascertain to what degree the CIA and the intelligence community, and remember, the intelligence community is made up of 17 different intelligence agencies. It's been expanded greatly since the 9/11 attacks, and there's a lot of money being wasted in the $70 billion budget for intelligence, which is more than the rest of the world combined spends on intelligence matters. I think what Trump is trying to do is make sure there's no contrarian activity in the intelligence community, no leaks from the intelligence community, and certainly no whistleblowers from the intelligence community. Trump hasn't followed up on the possible appointment. My guess is, and the rumor I heard, is that Senator Coats, as the intelligence czar, was infuriated by the idea that someone would be coming in initially to look over his shoulder before he had even been confirmed for his position as Director of National Intelligence. But when you look at the charges that Trump has made, the fact that today there was an op-ed in the Washington Post by a CIA officer who also served in the National Security Council saying he would not work for the Trump administration and has handed in his resignation, there is the kind of tension between the CIA and the White House that we haven't seen before. There have been presidents who've been critical of the CIA. I remember Richard Nixon was well known for asking Kissinger on various occasions, what is it those clowns out at Langley do anyway? And of course, what Nixon was furious about was the fact that the CIA wasn't supporting his war in Vietnam. They were providing intelligence to say the war in Vietnam was failing, this was a fool's errand, and strategic bombing wouldn't work in Vietnam. And of course, the CIA was right about all of this. Lyndon Johnson had problems with the CIA for the same reason. He did not like their intelligence with regard to Vietnam. The CIA director, Richard Helms, was finally fired by Richard Nixon for not giving intelligence on Vietnam that the White House was seeking and not supporting the cover-up of Watergate. So we've had these tensions before, but we've never had anything like the Trump war on intelligence. He's made it clear he doesn't need intelligence briefings. He's reduced the number of briefings that he receives. He's cut back on the kind of briefing that he gets. He wants very few items covered in the briefing. He claims he's a smart man and doesn't need to be told the same thing every day. So we're in a very unusual situation. And with the appointment of Pompeo, who is a big critic of the Iranian nuclear agreement, for example, which was an important international agreement, and the CIA was a major player in getting that agreement because you've never had an arms control agreement in this country going back to the SALT agreement and the ABM agreement in 1972, in which the CIA wasn't responsible for verification and monitoring. So there's plenty of reason to believe that there's going to be continued tension between the White House and the intelligence community. And the American public should worry about this, because if there is a threatening situation in the international arena, it's going to be the CIA and other intelligence agencies informing the White House of a possible crisis or a possible need to use force. And at some point, Trump is going to have to use CIA intelligence, which he doesn't seem to find credible, to justify actions that he could take in terms of explaining these actions to the American people. So we could see greater tension down the road, particularly when you look at the erratic behavior we've seen from the White House thus far.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. I would like to take a deeper look now at two issues that you mentioned. One is Iran, because with Trump surrounding himself with people who are opposed to the Iranian deal, including Steve Bannon, his chief counselor, I am reminded of some research that surfaced that was not discussed in the mainstream media at all, that to help stop Iran, even though it was under the strict review of the International Atomic Energy Commission, they had cameras set up, had locks on all the different components, were monitoring on a regular basis, none of which was told to the American public. We were led to believe this is a rogue state producing nuclear weapons. And Israel, Netanyahu in particular, made multiple statements about how it's only a matter of months before they have the bomb and then there's going to be chaos. In any case, as we found out, and it was only through an American firm that we found out that there was malware put into Iranian centrifuges by a joint venture between the National Security Agency, the CIA, and the Mossad. And what this did is it caused several thousand of their centrifuges to explode. Yet their equipment could not show in Iran that there was any error. So they thought it was something in the design, something in the mechanics of the centrifuges itself, but it wasn't. It was the malware doing its work, and it was considered the most unique type of malware that had ever been implemented. Now, here's where it gets interesting. When a company found what they had done, this information got out. China, Iran, and Russia started a whole program that if they could do that to Iran, could they also do it in some form of cyber warfare to them? And Russia is no, you know, backwards country when it comes to technology advancement, nor is China. In fact, Iran went on a major program of getting young people, and the majority of their people in their country are younger, to enlist in this program to protect their own nation. But at the same time, now here's what gets interesting. A separate piece of malware was discovered that the National Security Agency, supposedly the CIA and Obama and Clinton, didn't know about. And that was that all of the electricity would be could be turned off all at once. And this was done by the Mossad. So we would have to ask, for what reason? A preemptive strike. They certainly would have had the full backing of Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, but mainly Hillary Clinton. So it was something that I must guesstimate would have been done under her regime. And now that sets the stage of having, did someone in the CIA know it? I have no proof or evidence that anyone in the CIA actually knew about that. But it shows that the media is not explaining things to us about the real cause and effect in the Middle East, and how we always set ourselves up to be exceptional. We are exceptionally ethical, we're exceptionally moral, we're exceptionally democratic in all things we do. And then I look at the real world and I see our impact upon the rest of the world, and I have to ask, what would it be like to be a citizen in any of the countries that we have invaded and caused damage to the country, to the people, to their atmosphere, to their environment, to their standard of living? And we never apologize. We never say maybe we shouldn't have done this. And even those people, like you mentioned, George Tenet, if you remember, he was sitting right on the right-hand shoulder, right behind Secretary of State Powell, when Powell, in effect, and I believe him, didn't know he was being given false information. But that's what finally got us over the hump so we could have kind of a universal acceptance that we had to go to war. And think of all the suffering, and yet not a single person at the CIA or in the State Department has paid any substantive cost because of what they did. And I'm thinking, what does it say about we as a country when we can go to wars, when we can invade countries, when we can occupy countries, and we wouldn't be doing it without intelligence, like the Gulf of Tonkin, that was all lies. And why don't we have a press that is free enough from influence to report on these things? It always seems to come from outside of the main circle of the media, these breaking stories. Your thoughts on these issues, please.
Well, you raise some interesting points. And I remember when Colin Powell gave the phony speech at the UN in February of 2003, yes, he had George Tenet sitting over one shoulder and John Negroponte, the so-called intelligence czar, the first intelligence czar after the Intelligence Reform Act, sitting over the other shoulder. Neither one of these men wanted to be there because they knew this was the politicization of intelligence, but Powell thought the speech would have more credibility if they were there being represented as the CIA director and the intelligence czar. Powell was told, by the way, from a colleague of mine at INR, don't go out to the CIA to have that speech written for you. They will just take the phony intelligence estimate from October 2002, warm that over and bring it up to date, and you will be given a speech that basically will be no different than the phony intelligence estimate. But he ignored these warnings. And, of course, he learned in the wake of giving the speech that he was lied to, particularly by the deputy director, John McLaughlin. And he remains angry to this day, and every now and then it comes up in an interview. And I've talked to his chief of staff at the time, Larry Wilkerson, who's talked about the fact that Powell never should have gone out to the CIA to have this speech written for him. And this also begs a question about a larger issue. If Powell was opposed to the war, as he was through the summer and fall of 2002, why didn't he just resign when it was clear that Cheney was going to have his way with Bush and that we were going to go to this immoral war based on phony intelligence? And it's interesting that you raise phony intelligence with regard to Vietnam, because if you go back to the Mexican-American War of the 1840s, the Spanish-American War of the 1890s, Vietnam, the 1960s, and, of course, Iraq and the phony weapons of mass destruction argument, all of these wars were based on a phony intelligence. And we learn these things after the fact, but we don't learn them in a timely fashion. And frankly, it's because, to a certain degree, the press is not as zealous as it should be. And also, we don't have the whistleblowers that we need. We're in an environment now where we know there is illicit activity going on, but without the role of whistleblowers, for example, I know Edward Snowden is controversial to a lot of people, but the fact of the matter is the massive surveillance was a violation of the Constitution. And without Edward Snowden's revelations, we wouldn't know about those violations. Chelsea Manning, who has finally had her sentence commuted by former President Obama, revealed incredible details about war crimes that were taking place in Iraq that I think American citizens needed to know. Thomas Drake, the National Security Agency, who faced charges under the Espionage Act. And remember that President Obama was more zealous than all of our presidents combined in using the Espionage Act, which was passed in 1917 during World War I, used it on 8 or 9 different occasions, and they even pursued legal action against James Risen of the New York Times until Attorney General Eric Holder realized it would be an incredible embarrassment to pursue a New York Times reporter basically for doing its job, which was finding out about the inner workings of American decision-making on foreign policy. But to go back to Iran and what was called the Stuxnet virus, I think this was regrettable on a lot of levels. On one level, we should not have been cooperating with Mossad, with the Israeli intelligence services, because Israel not only was cooperating with us on the Stuxnet virus, they were conducting an assassination campaign. There were at least 3 or 4 Iranian nuclear scientists and technicians who were assassinated on the streets in Tehran by what we believe to be Mossad agents. I don't think the CIA was involved in any of this activity, but there is a certain guilt by association because of our involvement with Israel on the Stuxnet virus. The Stuxnet virus, to me, and this is important because of the charges now about Chinese and Russian hacking into American political systems and bureaucratic systems, the Stuxnet virus was an act of war. I think any time you introduce a virus of this type into the weapons programs of another state, you are committing an act of war. You are attacking the military complex of another government. And remember, there was an interview for which Trump has been heavily criticized when he referred to there were questions about Putin and what Putin was doing in Syria and Ukraine, and his response was, you know, we're not innocent either on these activities. We've done some terrible things, too. And everyone jumped on Trump for comparing the actions of Russia to the actions of the United States. Well, let's look at the actions of the United States. You know, I mentioned Iran in 1953, but Eisenhower also gave the order in the late 1950s to assassinate Lumumba, which led to the emergence of Mobutu in Congo, the worst tyrant in the history of Africa. I mentioned the Bay of Pigs and the various assassination attempts that started in the Eisenhower administration to kill Fidel Castro. Look at Nixon in Chile and the overthrow of the government and Kissinger's denials of U.S. Involvement. And Richard Helms, who lied to a congressional committee about the CIA role and paid a very modest fine of about $2,000 for lying to the Congress. So there are a lot of activities around the world that have involved regime change that the United States inspired. And since we mentioned Vietnam, remember, we had no Vietnam ally to work with because John Kennedy had given the order to neutralize the government, the Diem government
brothers.
Of South Vietnam. Once Diem was assassinated, there was never a legitimate government. There were a series of military regimes, but they weren't allies in the true sense of the word. And we were basically there fighting on our own hook in what was clear to me at the time, because I was involved in the teach-in movement at Indiana University when I was in graduate school. This was an unwinnable war, like Iraq, like Afghanistan. This was a fool's errand. And I don't know if you want to get into this, but it's interesting that just yesterday, Trump appointed Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster to be the National Security Advisor. I'm opposed to military people taking all of these positions that should be occupied by civilians because it really ignores the thinking of the Founding Fathers who wanted civilian control of the military. This was clearly established early on in our history. Well, McMaster wrote a well-known book about Vietnam called Dereliction of Duty. And in that book, his thesis was that the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff did not tell the truth to the White House. And the truth, as McMaster saw it, was the need for greater force. Well, my argument about Vietnam has not been that they didn't tell the truth to the White House. It's that they didn't know the truth, and they didn't seek the truth. Because the truth on Vietnam would have been we were never going to come out of that engagement in any successful fashion, that it was indeed a fool's errand. So now we have a military general who's not going to retire, by the way. He's going to stay on active duty as the National Security Advisor. You have a general who's gotten a waiver to be the Secretary of Defense. And in our history, previously, the only waiver that we've ever had was given to General George C. Marshall, who was a soldier's statesman and deserved a waiver. I don't put Mattis in the category of George C. Marshall. You have a Marine general at the Department of Homeland Security who is now stepping up the pursuit of immigrants in this country and basically repudiating what Trump said about only going after people who have guilty of serious crimes, of major crimes. You have a West Point graduate, Pompeo, who's taking over the CIA. So you have the militarization of foreign policy. You have the militarization of our national security policy. And when you look at people like Steve Bannon, the counselor to the president, who's been placed on the National Security Council, as a member of the Principals Committee, and only one time in our history has anyone ever been given that role, and that was Ed Meese during the Reagan administration. You can see that we're putting people into place who believe that all the problems in the world out there are nails, and we have the biggest hammer. So this is what concerns me. And when you add to that the subject that we talked about earlier in terms of the politicization of intelligence and how intelligence has been politicized in the past to justify war, I think there's a lot of reason why the American people better start paying attention to what is happening in their name in terms of government policy in the Trump administration.
Melvin, just hold it for a second. I'd like to reintroduce you. Professor Melvin Goodman is my guest. He is worked at the CIA for many years. He was a professor at the National War College for 18 years. And 24 years, he was administrator in administrations of the Johnson and Bush Sr. in the CIA and the Department of State. And we're going to get to some of the things I believe that based upon your background, you would have a much better knowledge than the average person in the media. But I just want to add a few more thoughts. Let us not forget, you mentioned the Gulf of Tonkin, but also Operation Northwoods, 1962. Let us add to that, additionally, we have Operation Gladio, and that was also Operation Ajax, A-J-A-X. That was 1953. You mentioned Eisenhower. Well, the CIA launched Operation Ajax in order to overthrow Iran's democratically elected leader, Mossadegh, and replace him with the Shah of Iran. Now, we are leaving the Shah out, and the consequences of putting the Shah as this ruthless dictator in place. The United States sought to depose Iran's nationalized Anglo-Persian oil company and to install five U.S. oil companies to take over the nation's oil fields. In order to do so, they staged a false flag operation that utilized propaganda and complex political maneuvers in order to create public revolt that eventually led to the United States and Great Britain's M16 military intelligence reinstalling the Shah in order to throttle Iran's oil supplies and transform the nation into a puppet regime of the United States government. And it's estimated at minimal that over 26,000 people were tortured and killed. Over 200,000 were held captive in prisons, and they were in the dark. The American media never responded to this. And in fact, the CIA in declassified documents from its CIA archives talked about what price they would pay for getting the Shah back in place. And we had Operation COINTELPRO. That was mainly the FBI, of course. But just to put a top on all this, if people think, well, the CIA is really all good and only occasionally does something wrong when there's a crisis to save the United States, I would like for them to take a careful look. 1948 in Italy, the CIA corrupts democratic elections in Italy, and then 53 in Iran, 54 in Guatemala, 59 in Haiti. The United States helps Papa Doc Duvalier become a dictator of Haiti. He creates his own private police force, the Tonton Macoutes, who terrorize the population with machetes. And they'll kill over 100,000 during the Duvalier family reign. We knew all about it. We supported it. 1961, the Dominican Republic. The CIA assassinates Rafael Trujillo, and then Ecuador in 1961, the CIA-backed military. 1963, the Dominican Republic, the CIA overthrows the democratically elected Juan Bosch. Ecuador, again in that same year, CIA-backed military coup overthrows the president. 64 in Brazil, CIA coup, military-backed coup. 65 in Indonesia, the CIA overthrows democratically elected Sukarno with a military coup. And then they've been trying to eliminate Sukarno since 57. They used every single assassination attempt they could. Didn't work, but they finally were able to get him. And they put a successor in his place, Suharto, who massacred up to 1 million civilians. And Dominican Republic in 65, CIA. Greece in 65, the king removes George Papandreou as prime minister, and Papandreou had failed to vigorously support U.S. interests in Greece. In the Congo and Zaire, the CIA-backed military coup installs Mobutu, that you were talking about, Seko, and massively murdering people. Only the former Belgium king did more, Leopold, in 67 in Greece, in 70 in Cambodia, in 71 in Bolivia, in 73 in Chile, in 75 in Australia, in 75 in Angola, in 79 El Salvador, in Nicaragua in 79, in 1980 El Salvador. In fact, the Archbishop of San Salvador, Oscar Romero, pleaded with President Carter. He said, Christian to Christian, to stop aiding the military government, slaughtering his people. Carter refuses, and shortly thereafter, he was shot. In 86 in Haiti, in 89 in Panama, in 90 in Haiti, again in 91 the Gulf War, in 93 in Haiti. So that's just a sampling of the things the CIA has been involved in. Have you heard one single columnist for CNN, the New York Times, go on record and say, let us hold our head in shame for the millions of people who have died and the hundreds of millions of people who have been adversely affected over the last 55, 60 years by the CIA and the American government intervening in their country?
Well, there's no question that there's a double standard in the pundit community and the media community. So we demonize Putin for what has happened in Crimea and eastern Ukraine and his support for Assad in Syria. But we basically ignore our own history in this area. And I think a lot of damage was done in 1975 and 1976. And that was, of course, the famous Church Committee hearings. And Frank Church, who I think was well-intentioned, talked about the CIA as a rogue elephant out of control, which gave the impression to the American public that, well, this was the CIA out there on its own hook, responsible for regime change and assassination policy. The fact of the matter is, if the CIA had been a rogue elephant out of control, a president could have put them under control. But the fact of the matter is, all of the events that you cite, every one was a policy or an action or a operation or a covert action that was ordered by the President of the United States. So it's the misuse of the CIA that I think needs to be addressed. Even someone like Carter, who was a great critic of CIA covert action, he was responsible for putting CIA support into Afghanistan even before the Soviets had intervened. This was an idea of Chomsky that really led to the introduction of Soviet force, which Brzezinski wanted to do because he knew this would be a drain on Soviet power. And when you think about it, the Soviet involvement in Afghanistan was no threat to the United States. But what grew out of the Soviet involvement in Afghanistan, which we covertly encouraged, was the Mujahideen and the Islamic movement that led to various organizations like Al-Qaeda and the Hekmatyar group involved in all sorts of terrorist activities, some eventually being aimed at the United States itself. So we have never looked at sort of the second and third order of implications of what happens when we take actions of this type. When we support a policy to overthrow Lumumba, do we realize that we're worsening the situation not only in the Congo but all of Africa? When we try to overthrow the Sandinista government in Nicaragua to support a corrupt group of Contras, do we really take into consideration this second order of implications and third order of implications, what will happen down the road? And that's why I am so opposed to putting military people into these sensitive civilian positions, because from my experience of teaching at the National War College for 18 years, the military does a good job of training tactical experts and operational experts, but they do not do a good job of training strategic experts, people who can think strategically, people who understand geopolitical problems, people who understand the importance of arms control and disarmament. The Pentagon isn't known for that. So you now have a situation where you have a Donald Trump who's never shown any curiosity about international relations or foreign policy, who admits that he doesn't read and gets his news not only from television but from the worst of television, such as Fox News, who has surrounded himself with a national security team dominated by the military, with not one individual having institutional memory of American foreign policy and American national security policy. And the only civilian in the group, and here I think this is laughable, is the former CEO of Exxon, who demonstrated in his confirmation hearings that he has no knowledge whatsoever of the international relationship other than how do you get oil and natural gas out of the ground. And, of course, he was very good at that. Exxon is the largest or the second largest corporation in the world. And Steve Cole of The New Yorker magazine wrote a wonderful book about Exxon and Tillerson's role in this capacity. But right now, this to me is an extremely dangerous time in American national security policy because we have tremendous chaos and disarray in the whole field of American foreign policy. Trump has done tremendous damage in just 1 month. We usually talk about the danger of the first 100 days. Well, we've seen a lot of chaos in just 30 days, and we have a team around Trump that lacks the experience, lacks the background, lacks the institutional memory that is needed for making good strategic decisions. So there's plenty to worry about in this regard.
Okay. One area that is a major concern to me is this starting a new Cold War, both with China, Iran, and Russia. And this is where that whole construct of the deep state, those who have the power to profit from the Cold War or Hot War, they're the ones whose companies make the weapons, they're the ones who are getting the private bids on contracts. They're the ones who end up, for example, in Afghanistan, it was showed in the Inspector General's report on Afghanistan, where the money went, that at one point it was $400 per gallon of gasoline, diesel, to drive a truck in Afghanistan. Billions were blown, and those ended up in people's hands. No one was held accountable. No one was arrested. No one had to give the money back. It was like the expensive toilet seat. I don't remember now how much the toilet seat was, but it was at one point it was exposed. It was tremendous. You're looking at $1.5 trillion for the plane that is a complete boondoggle, and including Bernie Sanders being a part of that. And yet we don't do anything to stop it. It only increases. So whatever the military-industrial complex, the spy complex, whatever they want, they get. Now, here is what I'm concerned with. I'm really concerned about NATO. Pence was out there telling how we've got to double down on NATO and give it more money and they have to spend more. In my opinion, my own personal opinion, having done extensive research on NATO and its history, it should be deconstructed. It serves no useful purpose today. And if people want to say, well, it did a good job in Libya, I will remind those people that irrespective of what you think of Gaddafi, Libya, of the 54 countries in Africa, Libya had the longest life expectancy, the highest literacy rate of 84%. They had free education. They had free medical care. And if you couldn't be helped in Libya, they'd fly you anywhere in the world and pay for your, that. You were given a large sum of money if you got married and had a child. You were given free home. The gallon gasoline only cost 17 to 27 cents, and the money that came into the country was going into central accounts and would be distributed to Libyan people. They had zero crime. It was considered the Paris of Africa, and yet now look at it. It's a completely failed state. People pride themselves on that look what we did to Libya. What exactly did you do to Libya? I've got photographs. I've interviewed people in Libya. I've interviewed many people in Libya, and they tell me that it was not a threat to the United States. We now find out from WikiLeaks that the information that the CIA used to get Hillary Clinton involved and Obama involved was false information. And so now I believe they're going to try to do the same thing with Russia. So would you please, in the time we have remaining, about 6 minutes in this hour, could you tell us about what you believe is the false narrative being given by Gloria Nuland and others in the State Department and in Congress and the media about the threat that Russia represents, and therefore they took out of the equation the Crimea and Ukraine, and all the blame is on Russia. You're familiar with that? Please tell us your perspective.
Okay, let me address this because there's important factual material that the American public just doesn't get exposed to. Now, if you go back 25 years, the Soviet Union collapsed. It gave the United States an incredible strategic opportunity to reorient its foreign policy, to have an important strategic debate, and really find a different way of doing business in the international community, and certainly to reduce defense spending. Now, one of the key events during the collapse of the Soviet Union was how do you get Soviet forces, there were 380,000 Soviet forces still in East Germany. We weren't going to go to war to get them out of there. So we made a deal with Gorbachev, who I think was the major player in ending the Cold War. He deserves all the credit that we've unfortunately given to Ronald Reagan. James Baker went to the Soviet Foreign Minister, Edward Shevardnadze, and George H.W. Bush went to Gorbachev and said, if you get your troops out of East Germany and allow East and West Germany to unify, we will not leapfrog over East Germany to go into Eastern Europe. We didn't put this in writing, but it was put in a verbal statement. I interviewed Shevardnadze for a book that I did on Edward Shevardnadze. I interviewed James Baker, who confirmed that he used the word leapfrog, that we wouldn't leapfrog over East Germany. And that's exactly what Bill Clinton did in the mid-1990s when, to stave off an election issue by Bob Dole, he made the terrible strategic decision to expand NATO by bringing in former members of the Warsaw Pact, the East European alliance system that was formed to counter NATO in the 1940s. George W. Bush took it one step further, made it even worse. He brought in former Soviet republics, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, into NATO. So NATO now is a conglomeration of about 26, 27 nations. We've basically taken the old Cold War lines and drawn them closer to Russia itself. In addition to expanding NATO, George W. Bush abrogated the ABM Treaty, which was the cornerstone of arms control and the cornerstone of deterrence and the cornerstone of strategic equivalence. He deployed a nationwide missile defense in California and Alaska, which doesn't work, and then he took it one step further by ordering a missile defense, which Barack Obama continued, into now Poland and Romania. So instead of demonizing Putin and demonizing Russia, and demonization is not a policy anyway, and it won't get you anywhere, we have to acknowledge that Putin is responding to these various American actions, including George Bush's interest before he left power to bring Georgia and Ukraine into NATO. And if it hadn't been for Angela Merkel, who I still think is the most impressive international leader we have today in the global community, I think Bush would have taken a move in this direction. But Merkel made it clear to Bush that Putin has drawn a red line with regard to Ukraine and Georgia, and it would change the international equation if we moved in this direction. But we've done a lot of damage over a 25-year period when we could have sought and probably achieved a much more benign relationship with Russia. Even today, when you look at the Russian-American situation, which is in many ways a resumption of the Cold War, when you look at the atmospherics around Moscow and Washington, I think this could be corrected by giving some East European guarantees to Putin that we don't want Georgia. We don't want Ukraine into NATO. We talk about Russian overflights in territorial waters. We never talk about, and there's very little in the press, on the fact that we just conducted a 10-day naval exercise in the Black Sea. We only go into the Black Sea for one reason, and just to confront Russia, to show the weakness of Russia around their own territory. We put a lot of emphasis on the fact that one intelligence collector was off the coast in the Atlantic Ocean, and it was by my own state of Maryland and moving up toward Delaware and toward New England. Well, we don't talk about the Black Sea exercise that we hold. We don't spend a lot of time talking about the aircraft that we put in the Baltic Republics, the troops, the battalions that we rotate through Poland and through the Baltic states. So there's a lot that could be done. And Trump has referred to this. I don't know what he really means by it. His motivations with regard to Russia still aren't clear. And clearly, General Flynn was the wrong person to be the National Security Advisor because he had gotten too close to the Russian state and had lost all credibility, and it was a conspiracy thinker in the first place. But Trump, who wants to improve relations with Russia, has now put into place a lot of people, particularly the military people, who have traditional military attitudes toward Russia. And again, having taught at the War College for 18 years, I can tell you the military's thinking about Russia is nothing beyond what we thought during the Cold War. It's this incredible exaggeration of the so-called Russian threat. The Russian bear is 10. It's the same old propaganda and agitprop that we've heard for years.
I appreciate your final comments here, and also appreciate you taking your time to come on to share and enlighten us on the people behind the scene, the people who have the power, and the loss of balance, the loss of people who are there to advocate on the American public's behalf instead of the special interest behalf. And a lot can be gained from reading National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, which validated Eisenhower's warnings. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Gary, thank you for allowing me to talk about these issues and devoting so much time to, I think, important issues that don't get enough attention.
Professor Melvin Goodman, my guest, and his website is melvingoodman.com. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Now, we have part two in about 2 minutes. I want to thank you all for listening to part one. Please stay with us.
Brother, brother, brother.